Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Well, Charles Darwin turned 200 on Thursday, and this year also marks the 150th anniversary of his On the Origin of Species.
And so we're continuing the celebration with All in the Mind and the Philosopher's Zone combining forces today to consider how Darwin's work radically influenced the life of the mind. I'm Alan Saunders.
And hello, I'm Natasha Mitchell. So let's get out the birthday candles.
Happy 200th birthday, Charles Darwin. You don't look a day over 180.
My name is Dalton Hedges. By the way, he was born on the same day as Abraham Lincoln, so that's one measure of the man's greatness. And my birthday message to him would be, well, bloody well, happy birthday, and I wish you were here.
Colin Groves, School of Archaeology and Anthropology, Australian National University.
Of course, Charles Darwin turns 200 this week. What would be your birthday message if he was here now?
I would say, happy birthday, Charlie. Thank you for all you have done. And certainly your knowledge and wisdom and your thoughts have been naturally selected over this past 150 years.
I'm very grateful for your genius and for transforming our view of human nature.
This is not just a museum relic of the 19th century, you know, sort of a statue of Queen Victoria that we may or may not venerate. I mean, the great thing about Darwin's theory is that it is such an exciting and controversial theory as science today, and that's when philosophers like me start to prick up their ears. I mean, it's when the cat's away that the mice do play.
I was talking with Roger Short, grand old man of evolution-minded reproductive biology today.
And he's an Australian, obsessed with sex.
Obsessed with sex. Hi, I'm Martin Daly. I'm a Canadian psychologist from McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario. He said, and I was sort of pleased because I'd had exactly the same thought, we'd come out of a talk. We'd both been having the thought, I wish Darwin could hear some of this stuff. He would just love it.
Yes, he said a beautiful thing, didn't he? He said, at one point, in the middle of his presentation, which was about sex and the evolution of HIV and penises and vaginas and all sorts of things, he said, come in, Charlie. And we all looked around, oh. And he said, oh, wouldn't it have been wonderful if he'd been here, because he couldn't have talked about sex in the way we do now.
Yes, and Darwin would have been delighted to be able to see how the methods available to biologists have enabled them to get a richer and richer understanding of evolution.
The ape was a most unsightly one. The ape was a most unsightly one. So it would not do. His scheme found the rule. For the maid, when his love took formal shape, expressed such terror at his monstrous error that he stammered an apology and made his escape. The picture of a disconcerted ape.
Well, as one philosopher said recently, if you think of the 150 years since the publication of Origin of Species, it had half that time in the wilderness and half at the centre. And even at the centre, it's often been not more than marginal. But now we've pretty much taken it on board, the whole package, not just evolution, but the mechanism, natural selection. And that's what makes Darwin every bit as relevant to the issues of our day as he was to those of his own day.
Absolutely, Alan. And at the conference in Melbourne this week called Evolution the Experience, you really got a sense that Darwin's legacy is alive and thriving. Colin Groves, one of the world's great paleoanthropologists, certainly thinks so.
Yes, his relevance is perhaps greater today than ever, because it has kind of spread its tentacles around through social issues, economic issues, as well as sex, reproduction, knowledge of the natural world, threats to the natural world through climate change, through extinctions. All this is very relevant today, much more so than in his own day.
Colin, if you had a scientific question you could ask of him in person, I wonder what that would be. Could you limit it to one?
I certainly couldn't limit it to one. I might ask a rude question like, why did it need John Gould to explain to you the significance of the Galapagos finches? Perhaps a few other things like, when you were on the Falkland Islands, or the Malvinas, you know, I'm not prejudiced, you saw some of the last individuals of the so-called Falkland Island wolf. What was your opinion of it? Did you think that it might be an indigenous animal or perhaps an escaped dog? Were there originally indigenous people in the Falklands? Did you consider this sort of thing? Because you're almost certainly the only naturalist to have seen it in existence.
Powerful questions. Wish he was here to answer them. Thank you, Colin.
Thank you very much.
And to start in life on a brand new plan, he christened himself Darwinian Man. He christened himself Darwinian Man.
My name is Jonathan Marks, and I'm professor of anthropology at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte.
Do you think his legacy is as much alive today as it was 150 years ago when On the Origin of Species was published?
Well, when The Origin of Species was published, he had a reputation as a scientist, but the scientific world was very different back then. In fact, there wasn't even really a professionalized discipline of biology. Thomas Huxley was really responsible for professionalizing the field of biology in the Anglophone world in the late 19th century. And so the professional academics is so different now, and certainly our understanding of the world is quite different as well.
Until Darwin's theory of natural selection, the view was that the universe had come about either through intentional activity, which could only be on the part of God, or through mere chance. And this really put the burden of proof on those who thought it had come about by sheer chance.
Stephen Gaukroger is Professor of the History of Philosophy and of the History of Science at the University of Sydney. And it's his view that whoever might have killed God for a lot of people in the 19th century, there's no blood on Darwin's hands.
With natural selection, you get a genuine third alternative. What natural selection does is it gives you a glimpse of a process whereby you can get from simple building blocks to organized complexity in a way that's neither random nor intentional. And this was a very major blow to Christianity in the wake of Darwinism, because it meant that traditional understandings of nature as God's creation were now put on the back foot. The burden of proof was now put on them, because what we now had was an understanding of how natural processes could emerge into something that had organized complexity without invoking some conscious or intentional act on the part of a creator.
The story is that the growth of evolutionary theory, the growth of Darwin's theory of natural selection and the apparent success of this led to the decline, at least among the educated classes, of religion. Is this in fact the case? Is that what did it for religion?
No, that could never do it for religion. Reading a science book doesn't undermine one's faith in religion. It doesn't now, and it didn't do in the 19th century. I think people's religious views are undermined basically on moral or quasi-moral questions. When they come to think that the religious beliefs that they've had and the religious system that they've adhered to has failed them morally, has not satisfied what they believed its crucial function to be, which was to provide moral guidelines and itself to exhibit a paradigm form of morality. I mean, there are statistics in the 19th century for people who particularly gave up Anglicanism from the crisis of the 1840s onwards. There's a massive decline in the authority of Anglicanism. But the advances in science are never given as a reason by those who are affected in this ways. There's a dissatisfaction with Anglicanism on moral grounds, particularly with the rise of the evangelical movement. But there's also a rise in a historical understanding of the Bible and a historical understanding of Christianity, which seriously undermined its authority from the beginning of the 19th century onwards.
This was what was known as the higher criticism, and it tended to be German or German-inspired.
It was indeed German-inspired. Really, from the late 18th century, there had been detailed biblical criticism. And by the 1860s, theologians, I think, were much busier with the consequences of biblical criticism than they were with natural science. This was the great threat to religion. It just so happens that Darwinism came at the same time.
What about the situation of the human race? I mean, I think one of the reasons that we tend to believe that the theory of natural selection must have had a consequence for religion is that instead of man being a little lower than the angels, he now comes to be, well, as the American evangelicals sang in the 20th century, kin to the monkey. That looks like a serious change in the position of humanity with religious consequences.
It's a serious upping of the stakes, though those views had been around from the middle of the 18th century. Certainly the idea that orangutans were very close to human beings was alive and well in the 18th century. So people had held continuities, held the view that there's a continuity between higher mammals and human beings for 100 years. The thing is, it was now put in a scientific context, in one in which there was copious observation, proper argument, and the rest of it. But of course, in The Origin of Species, Darwin tends to hold back on the case of human beings. It's Huxley who jumps into the fray immediately after that, arguing explicitly for the connection between the evolution of animal species and human beings.
So if we're to place Darwin in the context of his times, I gather that The Origin of Species was not the scientific bestseller of the 19th century. I think it wasn't even in the first dozen of the scientific bestsellers. So if we're to place Darwin in his context, we should see him as an important figure, scientifically a decisive figure, but perhaps in the broader context, not quite as decisive as we sometimes take him to be.
This would have disappointed Darwin a little bit. I mean, he did originally plan The Origin of Species to comprise three volumes, the third on human beings. But when he learned of Wallace's simultaneous discovery of natural selection, he had to get into print more quickly. What he wrote was what he believed was a more popular presentation of it. And indeed, the Origin of Species is a good read compared to many biology textbooks. So he himself would have been a bit disappointed, but he himself realised that the big issues, the ones that people were really interested in, was human beings. They weren't so interested in barnacles and pigeons and the other things that he looks at in great detail. They were interested in the consequences of this for human beings, and he drew back on this. He prepared the ground by presenting a thorough theory of natural selection first. If he'd presented his account of humans in The Origin of Species as originally planned, then I think it would have had much bigger sales and a much bigger impact.
September 15th. The Beagle arrived at the southernmost of the Galapagos Islands. This archipelago consists of 10 principal islands, of which 5 must exceed the others in size. They are situated under the equatorial line and between 500 and 600 miles to the westward of the coast of America. The constitution of the whole is volcanic, with the exception of some ejected fragments of granite, which have been most curiously glazed.
I'm Jeffrey Miller. I'm an associate professor of psychology at University of New Mexico, and I work mostly on the evolutionary psychology of human nature.
As an evolutionary psychologist especially, what was the explanatory power for you of the ideas he published in The Origin of Species?
The explanatory power for me as a graduate student at Stanford in psychology, searching for something that could integrate the jigsaw puzzle of psychology, was evolution provided a huge unifying force. It made a consilient, progressive science out of psychology. It gave us deep insights into everything from human emotions and preferences through psychopathology and mental health issues to economics and consumer behavior.
You know, that said, many biologists have been rather reluctant, haven't they, to apply Darwinian thinking, evolutionary theories to the human mind. How do you view that reluctance?
I think many evolutionary biologists historically, particularly figures like Stephen Jay Gould and Richard Lewontin, have been very intent on keeping biology insulated from social criticism and political discussion when it comes to human nature. They want biologists to be free to do their work in peace without engaging too much with the behavioral sciences, the arts, the humanities, or policy discussions. Evolutionary psychology threatens that, so it's uncomfortable for a lot of evolutionary biologists who study other species. But I think it's absolutely crucial in the early 21st century in a globalizing society for us to have the best understanding of human nature we possibly can to deal with pressing issues like climate change, warfare, economic inequality.
I guess the concern is that we're complex beasts, we are beasts, and to reduce everything to biology and our prehistoric biology is somehow reductive in an extreme way.
I think the wonderful thing about evolutionary theory is it's really a science of complexity. It's a science of the many, many adaptations that constitute animal nature or human nature, and it provides actually a much more nuanced and detailed picture of human nature than anything that's ever come out of the mainstream social sciences. So Marxism, Freudianism, postmodernism are all extraordinarily simplified and reductionistic pictures of human nature compared to evolutionary psychology, which has a whole lot more texture and finesse and nuance and intricacy to it.
Well, you'd certainly encounter a lot of debate there from those in the social sciences. You know, one of Darwin's great legacies is the theory of natural selection. You've been actually more interested in one of his other theories, and that of sexual selection. And I guess he had to be a bit prudish about sexual selection, this idea, because it was the Victorian era. Remind us of what sexual selection is and why it's led you to believe that fundamentally we have a mating mind.
Sexual selection is basically the realization that evolution proceeds by reproductive success, not principally by survival of the fittest. It's about getting copies of your genes into the next generation. And for species that reproduce sexually, that means you've got to find a sexual partner willing to merge their genes with yours to produce offspring, who are this wonderful hybrid. And in most species, that means mate choice. That means you have to appeal to the nervous system of the opposite sex, and the nervous system of the opposite sex, as Darwin realized, becomes a very powerful evolutionary force in its own right. It can shape species in all sorts of bizarre and novel and creative directions. It can create ornaments like the peacock's train or the mandrill's bright red and blue nose, or, I've argued, the human brain, that are very hard to explain in terms of survival payoffs.
You think the brain itself isn't an organ that drives our survival?
I think the human brain is in large part a sexual ornament in both men and women. Certainly many parts of it have been used in hunter-gatherer societies like our ancestors lived in for hunting and gathering and avoiding predators and raising children. But an awful lot of the capacities we have, such as language, sense of humor, a capacity for producing art and music, to me are only explicable as ways of attracting and keeping sexual partners.
Gosh, what about walking through the world and our cognitive powers and our intelligence?
I think the interesting thing about human intelligence and capacities for abstract reasoning and metaphor and analogy is how very poor most people are at being evidence-based and skeptical. What we love to do is pick up little factoids and half-understood theories and repeat them to others to be interesting, particularly on first dates. So we try to be interesting. We don't really much care about the truth of what we're saying, and scientists have to be extremely self-conscious about this, not just to be interesting, but to be right. Most humans, most of the time, though, adopt ideologies and beliefs that are there principally to make their minds attractive to others, not because those beliefs actually correspond to the world.
There you have it, one take on Darwin's sexy legacy for our brains. And Geoffrey Miller's book, The Mating Mind, How Sexual Choice Shaped the Evolution of Human Nature, certainly caused a real stir when it came out. And we'll hear about his new work on the prehistoric motivations for the modern consumer a little later. is an All in the Mind and Philosopher's Zone special celebrating Charles Darwin's 200th birthday with Alan Saunders and me, Natasha Mitchell. Anthropologist Jonathan Marks is interested in how Darwin and the biological force of his theory of natural selection has been used and abused by politicians, racists, eugenicists, and by scientists themselves. Jonathan Marks, thanks for joining us on ABC Radio National.
Pleasure.
Of course, Darwin has taken on a sort of larger-than-life personality in popular culture now. We've certainly seen an escalation of popular science books with titles like The Survival of the Prettiest or The Demonic Male. I mean, I have one of these come across my desk at least every week. What do you make of those sorts of popular science representations of evolutionary biology?
Well, some of them do Darwin credit, certainly. I would say probably about 80% of them have him spinning in his grave for one reason or another. Certainly Darwin didn't know anything about genetics, and Darwin also had the prejudices of his day as a wealthy Victorian country squire. But I think also there are a lot of very bizarre things being said in his name that he wouldn't even recognize as being part of his thought or part of any kind of thought at all about the natural world.
Well, one of your greatest consternations, perhaps, in our effort to construct so-called natural facts about humans through our understanding of evolutionary theories is, in fact, that comparison made between us, human primates, and non-human primates, other apes. You say we are manifestly not apes. Controversial. Some would say you're a creationist for saying such a thing.
Well, certainly I'm not a creationist. Evolution is the production of difference. That's what, you know, Darwin's book was, The Origin of Species. And what he was interested in demonstrating was how two species diverge from one another in an adaptive fashion and become different. And there is sort of a counterstream within popular science that tries to say that, well, we haven't really diverged from apes. We are just apes, sort of gussied over a bit, maybe hairy apes, maybe brainy apes, maybe aquatic apes, but we're just apes, and that just is always very important there. And what that does is it basically ignores the way that we are, in fact, quite different from apes. I mean, we're sitting here talking, and Boo Boo and Bam Bam simply aren't doing that. Not only that, but we're cutting our hair, we're pulling our wisdom teeth, we're dressed, we walk, we cry. These are all things that apes don't do. And more importantly, you know, we threaten one another by brandishing our lawyers rather than our canine teeth. So we are, in fact, quite different from apes, which is not to say we're not very closely related to apes, but to ignore the ways in which we are different, I think, is to ignore the fact of evolution. And if you want to say that we are just apes and not really different, it seems to me that's the person that's denying evolution.
Well, that's a very strong statement that you make, that to say we are apes is to deny evolution. What are the implications, as you see it, of this equation, ape equals human, human equals ape?
If we sort of generalize and say you are just your ancestry, well, think about that. I mean, that justifies ancient aristocracies. It justifies, you can never transcend the poor circumstances that you arose from. And, of course, these were very powerful ideas in older times. So I think what we need to recognize is that the things that you do during your life may make you different from your ancestors, that you can transcend your ancestry.
I mean, what you're saying is that we transcend apes. Is this sort of going back to the great chain of being sort of concept that had us all sitting in a sort of divine architecture? We were just under the angels, apes were way down.
I would rather see us as diverging from apes rather than ascending from apes, because certainly for every great thing that humans have done, there's an equal and opposite horrid thing that humans have done. But the bottom line is, we're the ones doing it. We're the ones driving apes to extinction right now. They're not driving us to extinction. And that's a very important ecological fact. And not to acknowledge that seems to me to miss some of the most important things going on the planet planet Earth at the moment.
Well, one of the reasons that people think it a worthy exercise of studying ape behaviour in order to understand the origins of our own behaviour is that we share 98 to 99% of our DNA with apes.
The problem is that it's not clear that that's necessarily more than we would expect, given the fact that our bodies are remarkably similar to ape bodies as well. What DNA sequence comparisons do is they give you a non-contextualized answer. You can just compare two DNA sequences, add up the differences, divide by the total, and that's your number. If you look at our bodies, you can pretty much tell any part of the body apart when you compare a chimpanzee and a human if you know what to look for. If you don't know what to look for, the femur, thigh bone of a chimpanzee and the thigh bone of a human do look very, very similar. The problem is that once you add some context to that comparison, the anatomical comparison, let's say, how similar is the femur of a chimp to the femur of a human in the context of a starfish, an echinoderm? Well, in that context, the human and the chimp match perfectly. I mean, the starfish doesn't even have bones, much less a thigh bone. So compared to a starfish, humans and chimps are extraordinarily similar, perhaps 100% similar. The concern is, I think, that DNA is far more exotic, and the whole world of genomics and DNA comparisons is not as self-evident, the meaning isn't as self-evident as we would like to think it is.
You also provocatively argue, Jonathan Marks, that Darwinian thought needs not only to be protected from the creationists, but perhaps sometimes from science and scientists themselves.
Well, unfortunately, if you look at the history of evolutionary biology, what you find is that every generation, people have been brandishing Darwin's name in support of very weird and sometimes very evil political theories. And science and society have always, science and politics have always intersected like this, and people use nature to rationalize political ideologies. You know, if you go back to the age of the late 19th century, people were using Darwinism to justify colonialism, genocide, expansionism. That turned a lot of other people off to Darwinism. A generation later, they were talking about sterilizing the poor in Darwin's name, restricting immigration in Darwin's name, certainly in the U.S. And if you argued against it, they beat you over the head with Darwin, they beat you over the head with Mendel. And then a few decades later, everyone says, oh, we never believed that anyway. Well, the fact is, yeah, the geneticist, the evolutionary biologist, not only believed it, but if you argued against it, they would call you a creationist for disagreeing with them. And this is, in fact, one of the great difficulties with any science that doesn't look at itself reflectively and historically, which is it allows you to make the same mistakes over and over again. I think in science we don't have the right to make the same mistakes over and over again. We only have the right to make new and creative mistakes.
Jonathan Marks, anthropologist and author of What It Means to Be 98% Chimpanzee, Apes, People and Their Genes.
During the greater part of our week on shore, the sky was cloudless, and if the trade wind failed for an hour, the heat became very oppressive. On 2 days, the thermometer within the tent stood for some hours at 93 degrees. I will now offer a few general observations on the natural history of these islands. I endeavoured to make as nearly a perfect collection in every branch as time permitted. The plants have not yet been examined, but Professor Henslow, who has kindly undertaken the description of them, informs me that there are probably many new species, and perhaps even some new genera.
Darwin, going around the world on HMS Beagle gathering specimens. But was that how he did science? Was that all he did? Put together a lot of facts? Well, that's what Darwin sometimes rather modestly said he did. He claimed that he worked on true Baconian principles and without any theory collected facts on a wholesale scale. Well, Baconian principles, for most Victorians, the true mark of scientific respectability, had been set down two centuries before by the philosopher Francis Bacon. But how much did they really matter to Darwin? Stephen Gaukroger.
There was a sense in the 19th century that it was Bacon who had established English science on a firm basis at the beginning of the 17th century by focusing on facts rather than on theories. But one thing I think Darwin was doing was marking himself out from a mathematical project. That's to say, he was saying there's a genuine way of doing science that's not the mathematical way. But he was also, I think, indicating that what he was doing was somehow ideologically and religiously neutral, that it was just concerned with facts, and that therefore it was immune to the larger scale debates that were going on in England and elsewhere at the time.
The interesting thing about Darwin was that, having said that he proceeded on Baconian principles, collected facts without theories, a little while later, he says that he couldn't resist forming a hypothesis on every subject.
Well, you can't, and nor could Bacon. I think the issue about Bacon is what your starting point is. Your starting point is a massive accumulation of facts. You then sift through and form hypotheses on the basis of these. I think the contrast is with the idea that you think up a hypothesis and then you look at the evidence to see whether it's true.
And it's clear that argument is important to him in science, and again, not just facts. A little while later in the autobiography, he says that the origin of species, contrary to what some people think, is one long argument from beginning to end.
Well, evolutionary theories were not new with Darwin. They have been defended in a number of ways, but they weren't backed up in the way that Darwin backed them up, and they certainly weren't given the kind of detail that enables one to think through exactly what happens. The other thing is that the evolution of non-human species and social and political evolution, whereby the rich and powerful have got that way because of a natural process of competition that allows them to rise to the top, were very closely associated. And Darwin really had to distance himself from those kinds of questions. And argument and evidence are really crucial to what Darwin does, and mark him out from the many types of evolutionary theory that had preceded the origin of species.
Stephen Gaukroger, author of The Emergence of a Scientific Culture. Darwin's argument is that in the struggle for existence, some mutations will be, as the saying is, adaptive. They will enable a species to survive and perhaps to thrive in the face of competition and environmental forces. But is this a law of nature, like one of the laws of physics?
Oh, I think so. I mean, in fact, I think Darwin was very self-conscious about this.
Michael Ruse is Professor of Philosophy at Florida State University.
First of all, he argues that we argue to a struggle for existence. And of course, he's using Malthus's principles of population here, that population numbers tend to go up geometrically, and food supplies in space at most can only go up arithmetically, if that. And so clearly Darwin is, for a start, arguing that organisms have this potential for reproductive explosion. And no, he's not saying that every time, everywhere, everybody is trying to reproduce. I mean, so if somebody said, well, what about the Shakers, for instance, that funny Protestant sect in America in the 19th century who did not reproduce? I mean, Darwin would have said, well, of course, it doesn't follow that it's going to happen all the time. But in general, what's going to happen is that organisms are going to have this tendency to reproduce and to reproduce more rapidly than food and space can supply. And so Darwin would certainly have thought of that as a law of nature. He would also have thought of it as a law of nature that organisms tend to vary. Not every organism varies in every respect every time, but that if you've got a reasonably large population of organisms, Darwin would have said, you're always going to get variation there. And this, combined with the struggle for existence, is going to lead to an ongoing process of natural selection. And I think Darwin would have said himself that natural selection is going to be a pretty universal law. Now, interestingly, the famous or notorious Richard Dawkins, the English biologist, has argued that this would hold throughout the universe as well, you know.
Let's look at things from another direction. Let's look at the evidence. I mean, one of the things that we expect of scientific theories is that they're going to contain predictions. Thanks to physics, I predict that if I raise the temperature of this water to 100 degrees Celsius, it will behave in a certain way. Now, I can do clever things with fruit flies, of course, which get through the generations very quickly, but is it difficult to get that sort of predictive explanation in evolutionary theory?
Fruit flies is a wonderful example. Normally, fruit flies are killed by alcohol. However, if you go to wineries, the wineries are absolutely overwhelmed with fruit flies. Now, why is this? Well, the hypothesis is that the winery fruit flies have been naturally selected in order not only to be able to tolerate alcohol, but in fact even to be able to feed on it and make a virtue out of what was a problem before. So here's your prediction, that if in fact you set up a selection experiment which is going to increase the amount of alcohol in a cage of fruit flies and run it over several generations, what you're going to expect at first is almost all of the fruit flies are going to get wiped out, except for a very few who are going to breed for the next generation. But what you predict is that over, let us say, 10 or 20 generations, you should expect to find that, in fact, far from the fruit flies being killed by the alcohol, they can tolerate very much higher levels than any of the original fruit flies. And in fact, Francisco Ayala and his students in the 1970s, working out of UC Davis, which of course is the big North American campus for study of winery and the grape and all of these sorts of things. It's in Northern California. And what they found was precisely what they predicted, that the fruit flies turned up trumps and you got alcohol-loving fruit flies. Now, it seems to me that this is just as much of an experiment with just as much of a predictive power as anything else. I think the question which is really interesting is, what's the scope of natural selection? It works okay with organisms. What about human culture? Does it work okay there? And of course, some people like Edward O. Wilson want to say, oh, yes, it does. And others like, well, Stephen Jay Gould, the late Stephen Jay Gould, would want to say, well, I'm not so sure. Now, here I think we've got, you know, a real ongoing live debate. Does it work okay with coffee cups?
They might lend themselves quite well to a Darwinian explanation, mightn't they? You put a coffee cup on the market, it's a coffee cup that actually spills coffee. It dribbles coffee when you try and drink the coffee. That's a non-adaptive characteristic in a coffee cup, so you would expect it not to survive. It's not fit to survive.
I think that's a good point. I mean, I'm not saying that natural selection doesn't extend to other areas. Of course it does. I mean, I've got no objection whatsoever to speaking metaphorically about, let's say, the evolution of the coffee cup or something like that. On the other hand, you should recognise that you're moving from the literal to the metaphorical, and one does run out of steam with metaphors after a while.
Yes, of course, the problem here is that there are imponderables that come into play. I mean, there is a famous fruit squeezer, lemon squeezer, designed by Philippe Starck, the famous French designer. It's completely useless as a fruit squeezer, but it's a very fashionable, or was once a very fashionable and rather beautiful object. So it's difficult with the material world, the human world, to predict what will be an adaptive characteristic and what won't. This just happened to be fashionable for a while.
Yes, Darwin was very, very careful to say, and particularly when we come to animals, and particularly when we come to the human animal, that success in the struggle for existence isn't necessarily just a question of being a he-man, a Tarzan type, a test quality cricketer, but that often attractiveness is something which comes into play very much as well. And so the big strong one might not do as well as the one which, for various reasons, appeals to the female, or and conversely. So talking about your fruit squeezer, its popularity might be explained less by its, you know, direct functional value and by the fact that it's a more beautiful thing to have. And I mean, we certainly see this, don't we, in auto design. There are many motor cars which are very, very functional, but one would not be seen dead driving one because, you know, it's the kind of thing that your mum drives. And so consequently, and I'm certainly one of these, you know, we go in for these two-seater, gas-guzzling, bright red objects, which give us a great deal of, you know, psychic satisfaction.
Philosopher Michael Ruse, author of Darwinism and Its Discontents, and in Australia this past week for Evolution the Experience, a conference celebrating Darwin's 200th birthday, as we are here on ABC Radio National with an All in the Mind and Philosopher's Zone special. Well, as you've heard, indeed the things we buy, that red sporty car and that Philippe Starck lemon juicer, have a Darwinian story too these days.
I think Darwin would be not surprised at all at runaway consumerism. He had such deep insights into sexual competition among species ranging from insects to birds to mammals to humans. He thought that sexual competition was so important in the evolution of human music and morality and altruism. And he would have been, I think, disappointed that economists, business people and critics of consumerism simply weren't applying those insights from Darwinism to understand the key phenomena that they're trying to understand, and in fact the key phenomena that are soaking up most of the hours of contemporary people, work and shopping.
Evolutionary psychologist Professor Geoffrey Miller, whose new book out in May is called Spent: Sex, Evolution and the Secrets of Consumerism.
So for the last 2 million years or so, we lived during human evolution in small-scale hunter-gatherer societies, little clans of 20 or 30 people, and they would interact with other clans to make friends and allies and choose mates. And there would only be a couple thousand people in your area who even spoke the same language. So we're used to caring a great deal about our social status within our local communities, and trying to be sexually attractive to potential mates within those communities or nearby communities. The reproductive payoffs for those were enormous, and our brains have been shaped in that environment to care about those payoffs. What happens in modern societies is we have those sort of vestigial instincts for caring what everybody we meet thinks of us, even if they're total strangers in a city of 10 million who will never meet again, who have no possible social or sexual interactions of any substance with us. And that's what marketers are really tapping into. You can see this particularly among teenagers. The need to have the Billabong or the Hollister clothing is so strong. The alternatives, different ways of displaying your intelligence or your personality through more natural means of communication, like simple conversation, become derogated. And so the marketers have convinced young people in particular that the only effective way to display themselves is through the consumption choices that they make.
But in a sense, you are also making the argument that we are deceiving ourselves. We're flaunting it, but we're faking it. And we're, in a sense, revealing our so-called genetic fitness in perhaps all the wrong ways.
What you see in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, for example, is this phenomenon of Jeddah boys who spend huge amounts of their country's petrodollars on luxury cars. They then customize them. And then they spray paint their email addresses along the doors. And they cruise up and down the streets and hope that women will email them and say, "Loved your car, let's have coffee."
A more gaudy example of internet dating.
It's a very clear example of Veblen's idea of conspicuous consumption, in this case in the service of Darwinian sexual selection. The funny thing about that tactic is it's really, really ineffective, inefficient, and wasteful. If you actually want to make friends and meet people, You have to do it face-to-face. That's the way that we're evolved to assess people, is through face-to-face conversation. What's interesting about young people today is they're circumventing a lot of conspicuous consumption through electronic communication like Facebook and MySpace and online gaming, where they can get to know each other and display their intelligence and personality traits without buying anything, and displaying your innermost being to tens of thousands of potential audience members.
So they don't necessarily need the liquid fitness that you describe money as.
Yeah, to a large degree, the evolutionary psychology of consumption behavior is a theory of coolness. It's a theory of why we think certain things are cool or rad or happening or fashionable. At the conscious level, we're simply tuned into what's happening now, what will increase my status, what will appear, you know, credibly connected to ongoing contemporary culture among my peers. That's at the conscious level. But what I'm arguing is at the unconscious level, we have all these motivations and preferences and emotions that are driving that behavior that are a genetic legacy of 2 million years of living in these little groups where social status was ever so important. And modern consumption is just an efflorescence and an elaboration of those instincts.
In all this, though, I want the genetic evidence. You know, I want those, because evolutionary psychology is full of great just-so stories about the psyche and why I wear lipstick and why men drive red cars. And I mean, it's full of gross, copious stereotypes about genders, races, age, the lot.
Well, one reason that this sort of Darwinian critique of consumerism was of interest to me is it really counters the stereotype that evolutionary psychology is intrinsically conservative, or that it's some kind of justification for the economic and social status quo. Anything but. I think if you're an insightful Darwinian, you have a whole new set of criticisms and insights into contemporary culture and economic policy that you'd never get without a Darwinian perspective. It also leads you to do empirical research that discovers things that never would have been discovered without an evolutionary perspective. For example, a study that my colleagues Vladis Griskevicius at University of Minnesota and me and others did showed that if you make people more interested in mating experimentally, that tends to boost interest in conspicuous consumption among men, but not among women. If you make women think about mating, it tends to boost conspicuous charity. They're interested in giving away money or doing things that are benevolent and altruistic. And here again, marketers didn't realize this. Marketers think you can make a sex appeal to female consumerisms that will boost their interest in luxury goods, but that doesn't actually work according to our data.
From an evolutionary biology perspective, you don't think that anti-consumer activists are actually hitting the nail on the head.
I think what the anti-consumerist and anti-globalization activists are missing is that human instincts for status seeking are there to stay. People are always going to seek status one way or another. And the idea that you can socially engineer people to be natural egalitarians or to be humble or not to care about sexual competition, I think is completely naive. But there are so many different ways that we can display ourselves to others that don't require wasteful consumption.
Evolutionary psychologist Jeffrey Miller. But evolutionary explanations of our contemporary selves don't especially wash with anthropologist Jonathan Marks. Concepts of a natural self or natural behaviors don't either.
Actually, if you look at the big picture, you get humans don't seem to have a natural state. And unfortunately, that particular viewpoint doesn't seem to come out, because what you get in evolutionary psychology tends to be a sort of justification for the status quo, the kinds of things you always knew to be true.
So, for example?
Women are breeders and men are seeders. Boys like to play the field and women want to go home with Mr. Right, which is, you know, a nice fairy tale, but, you know, a nice domestic fairy tale, but certainly can't draw any justification, as far as I can tell, from evolutionary biology.
Are you being a denialist, though, about the biological roots of behaviour, the potential that behaviour, our behaviour, has been shaped through evolutionary time?
Well, I think our behaviour has been shaped in certain ways. I mean, if you consider walking a behavior, if you consider talking a behavior, certainly that's part of our evolutionary heritage, quite different, for example, from apes. But if you grow up in one place, you're going to speak Chinese. If you grow up in another place, you're going to speak French. And that's certainly not shaped by evolution in the biological sense. That's obviously cultural, historical kinds of forces, which geneticists and evolutionary biologists don't have access to.
But if we come back to the premise of evolutionary psychology, this idea that all our behaviors can be investigated in terms of our desire to successfully reproduce and pass our genes on to the next generation. I mean, that's the lens through which they look at our behaviours today. To say that that's not the case is perhaps to deny that possibility that we are a mating species.
Well, indeed we are. But there is, I think, a problem of myopia if the only thing one looks at is mating opportunities. There's a great deal of literature about hierarchical thought in evolutionary biology, a wonderful book by the paleontologist Niles Eldridge called Why We Do It, which takes a very different view of the same sort of phenomenon and says, look, there are trade-offs in different ways. For example, not only are we interested in mating, but we're also interested in rearing. And those are actually quite different situations in the human life cycle. We also trade off our mating and our reproduction against careers. We don't breed as much as we could because we want to do other things, so we have economic costs and benefits. So things are actually a lot more complicated than the evolutionary psychologists seem to want to acknowledge, which I think is a problem.
The philosopher, the late Karl Popper, said that science, good science, starts with problems. The best science starts with a problem in the morning that you solve by lunchtime, but which means that you've got two fresh problems in the evening. Now, I think that's what makes Darwin's theory a great theory. It is a terrific theory. It does solve a huge number of problems. It tells you why those Galapagos finches are as they are. It tells you why the horse toes are as they are. It tells you about human evolution. So it tells you about those fruit flies. But at the same time, it pushes you and says, but there's more problems to be solved. Problems, for instance, like the origin of life itself, something which people are working on. Problems about development. How exactly does development take place from the DNA molecule right up to the living, breathing organism? And a lot of these problems certainly haven't been solved yet. And, you know, thank goodness they haven't, because good science is science which attracts bright people to do it. And bright people are not going to be attracted just by the possibility of polishing the successes of their parents and grandparents. So I would want to say Darwin's theory is terrific science, not just because of the questions that it's answered, but because of the questions that it's thrown up that it hasn't answered yet.
So we end with just what we want, a lot of unanswered questions, courtesy of the philosopher of science Michael Ruse from Florida State University, whose book Darwinism and Its Discontents is one of many that he's devoted to the great man's legacy.
And for more info about that and the downloadable audio and transcript for this Darwin birthday special, you'll find that on both the All in the Mind and Philosopher's Zone websites via abc.net.au/rn. And look for the All in the Mind blog there too. We'd love your thoughts.
The celebrations will continue across Australia all year. We'll link to the calendar of events so you can join in. I'm Alan Saunders.
And I'm Natasha Mitchell. Thanks, Alan. And thanks too this week to our naturally selected colleagues, Anita Barrow, Kyla Slaven and Angie Grant. Beautiful specimens. Bye for now.
Listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National. on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.